Welcome. This week we're going to talk about Fourier transforms and spectral representations. I want to make it more interactive and less theoretical than the last 2 weeks, but which is why I'm going to use the screen to show the packages, show you how to use them. And on Wednesday, you can then program by yourself instead of just following along to what I do. But before doing so, I want to briefly sketch something of the blackboard, kind of a general introduction of spectral representations and why that might be interesting. You might remember that I introduced two general ways to represent a function. One was a spectral representation. You take a function and you expand it. For example, in Chebyshev polynomials, you have f of x equals some kind of sum over coefficients, ci, and I used Legendre polynomials, going to use Chebyshev polynomials now. And the other way to represent functions was similar, but instead of Chebyshev functions, use something like hat functions, and then you get the finite differencing representation. In the exercises last week, we used the finite differencing representation, and you all appreciated how horribly complicated it is to use derivatives and end up doing all these calculations, which of course would be much easier with Chebyshev functions or Legendre polynomials. One disadvantage of a spectral representation is that it's very difficult to evaluate nonlinear terms. If you want to square a function and you have only the spectral representation, that's very difficult because you need to do a folding integral that's quite inefficient. So people use pseudo-spectral representations where you have both a spectral representation and a representation in terms of collocation points. Let me sketch that. For example, you have the x-axis here, then you have minus one, let's say again, plus one. 0, and then you choose a set of points at which you evaluate the function, your collocation points, and then you can perform the nonlinear calculations there. And say if you have 5, n equals 5, for example, if n equals 5, then you would have 5 coefficients, 0 to 4, and if you want to evaluate the function, then it might make sense to use 5 equispaced collocation points. That would then, for example, be, oh yeah, if I say equispaced, I should be better about my drawing here. I'm talking about collocation points. And the problem is, if you use equispaced collocation points, which we use to find a differencing, then this leads to large problems when you want to convert them to a spectral representation. And the intuitive reason for that is, if you look at, say, at how a Chebyshev function looks like, plus 1, minus 1, and a large Chebyshev function, either T100 or something, then these Chebyshev functions, they have look approximately like that. There's very high frequency oscillations near the outer boundaries, and they're rather smooth in the interior. And if you want to evaluate this function just at, say, a certain number of collocation points, then you're ignoring most of these wiggles, and you're sampling the center here much better. So if you want to have an accurate method of finding the coefficients for a given function, then you need to sample the function not on equispaced points, but rather on points that bunched up more towards the outer boundary. In other points, the questions I'm trying to answer is, you are given a function, a continuous function, and you want to find a spectral representation. So if you want to have n spectral coefficients, you need to evaluate the function at least at n points. Where should you put these n points to reduce the error? And it is a bit counterintuitive, but using equispaced collocation points is not the ideal way. It is much better to have the points bunched up near the outer boundary. The details, of course, they don't really matter because you can look them up. Probably even on Wikipedia, yes?
But that's only because you knew that the function has...
Yes, this totally depends on the basis functions that you have. If you have the hat functions for finite differencing, then the equispaced collocation points, which we used, kind of were good anyway. But for polynomial functions, for example, Legendre polynomials or Chebyshev functions, you need to do that. And so for each set of basis functions that you have, there is a certain optimal set of collocation points that you can use. And I believe for Chebyshev functions, the optimal set, no, I don't remember whether that's for Chebyshev functions, but for the Legendre polynomials, if you want to have n functions, then you take pn plus 1, take the derivative, and the zeros of this give you then the optimal locations. And kind of intuitive, there are many wiggles, so the maxima kind of bunch up here. They're not so much bunched up here. If you take the derivative, you find the location of the extrema, and this exactly gives you the right thing. And I assume numerically it doesn't really matter whether you do that exactly or whether you're slightly off by that. In particular, this prescription gives you no points at plus 1 and minus 1, but you start a bit in the interior. Sometimes you want the outer boundary points. You change that slightly, what you do here. And after that, after you sample the function, you have the function value at certain points. So let's call this fi, define this to be f at the collocation points xi. Did I label them? Yeah, let's call these xi, the collocation points. And then, of course, calculating the ci from the fi, that's just the basis transformation. So you get ci equals some matrix. Let's call it A. Fj. This is just the basis transformation, and this is a large matrix. If you have 10 or 20 collocation points, then you can just calculate these matrix element directly because you know the code, you know the functions, you know the values at the collocation points. You can orthonormalize them and everything. But the problem is, if you have many points, if you have a million points, or if you do something in 2D, if you took a picture of the cosmic microwave background and you have hundreds or thousands of modes and you want to go from the observation at a particular point to the actual mode number, then this matrix becomes very large and it becomes very inefficient. If you have n elements in a vector, then the matrix vector multiplication takes n cubed operations. So if you have a million elements here, then this would be 10 to the 18 operations, and that's really expensive. Hence, the search for more efficient algorithms to do a spectral transformation like that. And there exists an algorithm called a fast Fourier transform, which is much more efficient. A regular Fourier transform using a matrix would take order n cubed operations, and a fast Fourier transform takes only n log n operations. So it's essentially as fast as just looking at each of the vector elements only. And there are many other basis functions. Okay, I have to ask, what is the hat about?
It's my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday. Did not know that. Okay.
Tim has one too.
Happy birthday as well. And what this week is about Fourier transform and related transformations. And this is the reason why you would want them and why it's important to use a library for this, to get this efficient implementation. So there's a Fourier transform, which is the algorithm, sorry, which is the mathematical operation. There's a fast Fourier transform, which is the efficient algorithm. And the library name is FFTW, which is the fastest Fourier transform in the West. It's a bit cheesy, the title, I didn't make it up. It's a really widely used library. It's really well written, but the title is cheesy anyway. And it's also a bit difficult to use. So this is why I have the screen open. I want to walk through the documentation and essentially showcase how to use a library like that. So it's kind of two things I want to do at once. First, how to use an external library that involves a non-trivial amount of mathematics. And second, also showing you how to do that, that you can do a Fourier transform by yourself in the code. Now, this is... I talked about Chebyshev functions. It turns out if you want to transform this transformation for Chebyshev functions, you can also write this as a discrete Fourier transform calculating this matrix. And for other things, for Legendre polynomials, etc., you can write it in terms of a Fourier transformation. Okay, that's my sign, I guess. I switch to the computer. Okay. After this preliminary, I want to begin by looking at a Julia package that can perform a Fourier transform. and then walk you through the steps of how to do that yourself. So since you'll be on your own on Wednesday coding, implementing something with the Fourier transform, I want to mostly look at documentation today. It's just, I'll show you the documentation instead of writing something in a Blackboard. Probably need to increase that font size here. Is that good? Can you see that? And yes, thank you for the lights. Very good. So Julia has a package abstract FFTs, abstract fast Fourier transforms. And the idea there is presumably that there could be different packages that implement Fourier transforms. And this is an abstract interface in your code. You probing against that abstract interface, and you can then use any of the Fourier transformation libraries that exist. Now, this documentation here is good, but it's not stellar. So let's take that as an example and walk through that. If you click on the main webpage, here is this abstract FFTs. Sorry, I just want to. Yeah, I should not have done that. Let's go back. Anyway, the public interface, it doesn't give much background information. Instead, it just declares the functions that you could call. There is one function that you control, FFT. It expects one argument, A, presumably an array, and dims a certain list of dimensions. And if you read the text, I don't know whether I should read it aloud, performs a multidimensional fast Fourier transform of the array A. Optional dims argument specifies a subset of dimensions that it should do. Maybe you have a three-dimensional array and you want to only perform the Fourier transform in the x and y direction, because the third direction is, I don't know, you sampled over some parameters and you want to do that for every parameter. Hence, no Fourier transform in the parameter space. Most efficient is the product of small primes. So in particular, if the array size is a power of 2, that's a product of small primes, because 2 is a small prime. And this library is very much geared towards an efficient implementation, because if you have a small arrays, 100 squared or something, then the efficiency does not matter much. But if you're handling large data sets with millions or billions of elements, then efficiency does become important. And then it makes a difference whether it runs for a second or a minute or for hours. Plan FFT. This is the function that you call to perform the Fourier transform. And luckily, it also shows you the exact equation, the exact formula, which is for a Fourier transform. This is kind of agreed upon in the community what the various sign conventions are. But for anything more complicated, there are always different factors and sign conventions. And then, of course, you'd hope that the documentation shows that. So the discrete Fourier transform A of array element K is the sum, the exponential with the minus sign. And you're all familiar with the continuous Fourier transform. Here you have n minus 1 and k minus 1, because Julia starts with array indexing with 1. And the length of the array is just the number of elements. And this is the... Well, that's the equation, not much more to say. The next thing that is here, there's a note about performance here, because the authors of the package are presumably worried that you compare this against the Python implementation, which actually performs a different mathematical operation, and then you'd think that Julia is slower because Python does a different thing. This is a different version of the same thing with an exclamation mark at the end. That's the Julia convention. Functions that have an exclamation mark at the end modify their argument. So the first FFT function up there actually returns a new array with a Fourier transform of your input array, and your input is not changed. If you use this one with the exclamation mark, presumably it's faster, but it modifies the input array. And of course, that can be confusing. If you have an array containing something, you call a Fourier transform, otherwise later it contains something else. I recommend not using that unless you know for performance reason that's actually necessary. But for performance reason, people would do that, modifying the arguments of a function call. Then here, IFFT is the inverse Fourier transform. You see again the definition. There is a plus sign here, of course, the most important one. And the convention is that you divide by the length here. In math, I think people want to divide by 1 over the square root, both for the Fourier transform and of the inverse Fourier transform. When it comes to the surprising thing, there's a third kind, because there's a Fourier transform, an inverse Fourier transform, and a backwards Fourier transform. The backwards Fourier transform is defined here. It's the same as the inverse, but you divide, don't divide by the length, which is the same as multiplying by the length, because apparently dividing by the length is, it requires an additional pass of the array, so it's a bit inefficient. And if you look at the non-Julia implementations of Fourier transforms, they usually provide two functions, Fourier and backward, sorry, transform and backward transform. And you might think that the backward transform is the inverse transform, but actually it isn't. It's off by a factor of 1 over 2 pi. And it can be quite confusing when you do a Fourier transform and then you realize when you do the inverse transform after transform that the results differ by a factor of 2 pi. So this is, it's done so for efficiency reason, but it's not really helpful if you're teaching a class or trying to use that correctly for the first time. And then there's also something about plan FFT, because when you do a Fourier transform, just how you do that efficiently, you can plan that. And planning the Fourier transform takes a certain amount of time. So what you can do is you can first plan the Fourier transform. You look at the size and shape of the array, and then this is all optimized. And later on, when you apply the Fourier transform, you apply the plan. And that is in particular more efficient if you do a Fourier transform of the same shaped arrays many times. So if you do 100 very similar Fourier transforms, it's much faster to plan it only once and apply the plan 100 times instead of doing the Fourier transform just every time, because then you'd need to plan every time. So why am I talking all about this? Because nothing of this, of course, has anything to do with the Fourier transforms and with the mathematics, but this is rather software engineering. And if you're using an external package, then you might pick a package which is a bit difficult to use like that, but you have to understand technical details like that. There's nothing wrong with Julia or this module, abstract FFTs. It's a bit tedious to use, but it's there for a reason. And that interface was designed there for that reason. And then there are a few other functions that are defined in this package, abstract FFT. Oh, down here, yes. Fourier transform, of course, there's, you remember the exponential up there? All these Fourier transforms take real numbers as input and produce, sorry, complex numbers as input and produce complex numbers as output. So if you want to transform real numbers, then half of your input is zero, and everything can happen twice as fast if you explicitly pass real numbers in. Hence this real Fourier transform where the inputs are real and the outputs are complex numbers, but you only get half as many outputs, because the others would be just the same, because there's not enough information to produce more. And the inverse real Fourier transform from complex to reals, backwards, same thing again. And there's something here. Yeah, there's also a strange function that this package offers, shift. It shifts something by half the domain size. So if you have a computational domain and they have a function given here, then what this shifting does, and you've sampled it on a grid, what this does is produce a function like that, where this is just shifted by half a domain size. I don't know why this would be here in the package, but apparently the authors thought it's a generic thing that you would want to have. And oh, this is actually an interesting function, the frequencies. This returns actually the frequencies for each bin for the modes that you have. Because there are, of course, two different conventions to returning the modes. One convention would be that if you have an array, you have a 10-point array, do the Fourier transform that you get 10 modes out. One convention would be that the first element of the array would be the zero mode, and the second element would be the next mode, and so on and so forth. But you can also label the modes with negative and positive numbers, and then another convention would be to have the modes in order. So you start by the most negative mode, plus one, plus one, plus one, and the zero mode is then in the middle of the array that you get out, and the other ones elsewhere. And yeah, I guess the definitions up there, the sums that you saw, actually say that. But I wish that documentation was a bit more explicit about that and gave a nice introduction to that. Anyway, this is the function that actually returns the modes. So you can just call it once and look at the output, and then you see how things are ordered and whether everything makes sense. But in the end, it's, I think, still necessary when you use a library like this. You just call it a few times, look at inputs, look at outputs, and then figure out how things are actually laid out and how things are actually working. I don't know whether you want to do that today. So that'd be both today and Wednesday have a mixture of an introduction and a bit of playing around, or whether you want me to, or whether you rather prefer that I give a more of a theoretical introduction today, and then on Wednesday you're playing all the time by yourself, sorry, experimenting. Well, let me just give you a brief demo in a Julia notebook about this library, abstract FFTs. Actually, if I remember correctly, I said, is the kernel here? Yes, and that's a bit small. Let's make it larger. I use this FFTW library directly. Let me add it. And then I'm going to call some of these functions and do a Fourier transform in some smaller ways, and then just to get a feeling for how to do that. There's not much happening here, right? Just, Then I'm going to say using, then I'm going to find an array, A equals, probably wants floating numbers, 0, minus 1, 0, 1. And do a Fourier transform. Yes?
So here, FFTW is different from that one you just
I forgot to mention. Julia offers this abstract FFT package, and then it also lists all packages that actually implement it, and there's only one. So that was a bit of an exercise for naught, because the only package actually implementing it is FFTW. So when you have a piece of code, then you can use the abstract FFT interface. And if the only thing you do is use that interface, then you can later on more easily change between different implementations, FFTW or any others that there might exist, but currently there isn't. So therefore, I'm just using FFTW directly all the time. Okay, that was adding all the input. This is an array. What? No, I didn't want this array. I wanted 1 minus 1, sorry, 0 minus 1, 0 plus 1, which contains essentially a sampled sine wave. Hello? Yes. And if I do a Fourier transform, then you see all the real coefficients are 0, all the imaginary coefficients contain all the information. And it's not quite clear where the modes are. Let me do a real Fourier transform, which is what I should have done in the first place. And what was it called? RFFT frequency something? Sorry, here. FFT, RFFT frequencies. What? No, 4, right? Yes, because it was a 4-dimensional array. This is where the frequencies are stored. So that means, oh yes, my input array has 4 elements. So if I do a complex Fourier transform, I get 4 coefficients back. If I do a real Fourier transform, I get only 3 coefficients back. And the rule for that is you get half the array size plus 1 real coefficients back. Sorry, not real coefficients, coefficients of the real input array. The coefficients are still complex. So I get 3, because 4 divided by 2 plus 1 is 3. And the frequencies are 0, 1 quarter, 1 half. And the next frequency would be 3 quarters, or minus 1 quarter, which is the same frequency for a discrete Fourier transform. And that's the same as actually this one here of 1 quarter, because the coefficients are real. You seem skeptical?
No, I know you just explained, I just don't really get what the RFFT frequency.
Oh, so FFT is a Fourier transform of this element, the discrete Fourier transform, which gives you 4 coefficients because I had 4 array elements.
Yes.
Fourier transform likes to work on complex numbers, so I could have provided complex inputs, but I didn't. With a real Fourier transform, you get only half the number of coefficients, half plus 1 actually, which is why you have 3, but the coefficients are still complex. And I think the rule is that the first and the last always have 0 as imaginary number. So then it's the same amount of information in there, the same real number.
And the last one?
And the last one is the frequencies. So this here is the zero frequency mode, kind of the offset. And this is a frequency of 1/4 and 1/2. 1/2 times the array length, divided by the array length.
Okay, so
this is the constant mode, and this is the slowly changing mode, and this is the highest changing mode that you get in the array.
Like those two functions are independent. Like
they're independent.
Okay, so it's just putting that when you have four.
Yes, and the Fourier transform depends on the input array, and the frequencies just depends on the size of the input array. And this is, I mean, the output is really trivial and depends only on the size. This just gives you information about the structure of the output. And of course, the interesting thing is when you do the inverse Fourier transform after Fourier transform, IRFFT of RFFT of A. What? I should really prepare notebooks where everything has been worked out.
Say that every class.
I tell myself that you learn something from my failing here. It might just be that I'm not perfect, but you knew that anyway. Abstract elements. I have to look at the documentation. What is wrong with IRFFT? Okay. There you go. Because the inverse only has half the number of elements, and because when you divide an integer by 2, you don't know what the original was, because you round down, you actually need to specify a second argument which contains the number, the actual size of the original array. So this was the original array that you get back here. 0 minus 1. 0, 1. Can also use another array. 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1. 8 elements. And this is the highest mode that should be in there. So I expect an array that has all zeros except for the last element, which should be non-zero corresponding to the highest mode. And the what? Oh, of course, there's also a constant offset because I had only positive numbers, right? I could have written minus 1, 1, minus 1, 1, and constant offset wouldn't be there. So here, you have that constant offset, and this is the highest mode. These two imaginary numbers are always zero, and the other numbers are not present. And what I thought would be a nice exercise for you for Wednesday would be to produce, say, a Gaussian random field, where you choose a certain number of modes, and then you choose respective random numbers corresponding to a power spectrum that you want to have, and then you create a large array. Let's say you can take a two-dimensional thing, 100 by 100 modes, and you visualize the result. You should see a random field with a certain power spectrum. Oh yes, we can also do this in 2D, of course. RFFT, let me pass in a 2D array, 0, 1, comma 1, 0, and then you get as a result a two-dimensional array back. So I have a 2x2 array. The result is again a 2x2 array. Since it's a real Fourier transform, you get 2 divided by 2 plus 1. Again, 2 results back, and all the imaginary parts are 0, as you'd expect in this case. Okay, this is Fourier transforms. Do you have further questions? Okay, not so far. I'm sure there'll be lots of questions on Wednesday. Fourier transforms, and I also showed you multidimensional Fourier transforms, work quite nicely, but that's not the only thing that shows up. Every time you handle orthogonal polynomials, you want to do some kind of transformation, as I showed in the beginning. There's another Julia package I want to introduce called Fast Trans, I think. I think it's fast transformations, fast transforms, yeah. Always a bit skeptical if someone calls their package fast transforms, as if the most important thing is that it's fast as opposed to correct or easy to use and so on. But I mean, Julia has communities, and the community maintains certain packages. And there's one community called, oh, you can't read that atop here, Julia approximation. And this actually, they maintain, or they help the author maintain this package. And this package does a few things. So it seems to be a nice package. And it also seems to be the only package that actually supports spherical harmonics. And spherical harmonics are what I want to show, because they're always a bit iffy to use numerically. Oh, yes. So for the Fourier transform, if you want to do something with Legendre polynomials or Chebyshev polynomials along this order, then of course you might think you could implement yourself the Chebyshev polynomials or associated Legendre polynomials. And the issue with that is that the equations that you typically find in textbook, they work nice in Mathematica when you have exact representations, when you can evaluate factorials with arbitrary precision. But if you want to evaluate them numerically, then rounding errors can be quite gruesome, because they accumulate in these cases. And I would not be surprised if a naive implementation of a Legendre polynomial would not work beyond L equals 20 or similar. But just the numerical errors are so large, or maybe you orthogonalize or normalize something, that you then lose 15 digits of accuracy. So since you start with 15, you wouldn't get any useful results anymore. And in particular, if you want to do something up to thousands of modes, then it's very important that the implementation also has been vetted in that respect. And that is the most interesting thing you get out of packages like this. I mean, the fast performance is interesting as well, but the high numerical accuracy is quite interesting as well. So fast orthogonal polynomial transformations. This package seems to be a catch-all for everything. They have Legendre polynomials, Chebyshev polynomials, some Fourier transforms built in as well, although I don't remember whether they're exposed. And they have spherical harmonics, etc., that you can do. And let's just look through the section for spherical harmonics. And that is also a gem, how that is written. And if one of you felt so inclined to actually submit a pull request and improve that documentation after you figured out the information that is missing there, that would be cool. But I don't want to put that onto you. Spherical harmonic transform. Let F be an array of spherical harmonic expansion coefficients with columns arranged by increasing order in absolute value, alternating between negative and positive orders. Then SPH to Fourier converts the representation into a Fourier series, and a Fourier transformation converts the coefficients to function samples on an equiangular grid. And if you read that, of course, then you have to read that very slowly to understand it. This is very mathematical and also not very interesting. So if you want to evaluate, so you have Fourier the spherical harmonic coefficients, and you want to evaluate that on a sphere, then usually you want to evaluate it then at a grid with constant angles in the theta and phi directions, and constant distances in the angular direction. And this is what they mean by equiangular grid. So that makes sense. Does not sample the poles, okay? That means if you have 10 angles in the theta directions, that the pole is half a theta distance away, kind of half, and then it's 1d theta, and then another from the southernmost line to the south pole is again d theta over 2. Yeah, they don't write that. I'm just guessing that that is the case. And then the general algorithm that this package seems to use is that a spherical harmonic transformation is somehow converted into a Fourier transformation, and then the Fourier transformation is applied to evaluate the spherical harmonic coefficients. And of course, the first sentence here, let F be an array of spherical harmonic expansion coefficients arranged by increasing order in absolute value. I have no idea what that means. So let's do a bit of archaeology to see how that package actually works. So the package is called Fast Transforms. So let's use it. Oh, S missing. And let's just do this here. F is these this array. These numbers are large, right? I'm afraid this would give me now an array with 1,000 by 2,000 elements. So let's just use 4 and 9 as numbers here and look at the output. That's still a bit large. Let's use 3 and 7. Yeah, that looks nice. SPH rand n, that probably gives me a spherical harmonic expansion coefficients, normal, random, distributed. And you see it's an array that has a very, very suspicious triangular structure. So in the lowest row, you have one element, and then 3, and then 5. This kind of, and since I passed 3 as a parameter, it looks to me as if these were different L's of the YLM coefficients, and these were the different M's. And since they said something about increasing order of absolute value, I'm kind of guessing that this column is Engmibel 0, and then minus 1, plus 1, minus 2, plus 2, or something. But I don't know why this array kind of is kind of shifted towards the top, because for L equals 0, I expect only one coefficients, and then 3, and then 5, and not the other way around. Apparently, they shifted it in a weird way. Anyway, we can create such an array ourselves. Let's do that. F equals zeros, 3, 7. Yeah, that's good. And then let's F 1, 1 equals 1. And then we output F. And then we have an array that looks like that. So let's continue with the here. Let's just copy all of that. Once. And then we have this plan. The first plan converts the spherical harmonics coefficients to Fourier coefficients. The second one, the Fourier coefficients, sorry, that spherical, yes, the second one applies the Fourier synthesis. Synthesis means you go from spectral to the grid values here. And then let's apply that, and then we get the grid G. And this is now a grid, this equiangular grid on the sphere. And that looks good, right? So I set one of the coefficients to 1. This is probably the L0, M0 coefficient. This one here. And the elements are all the same. So that probably means this is the L0, M0 coefficient in this library. And if you're thinking this is a particular badly written library, it's not like that. So I'm currently looking in spin-weighted spherical harmonics in C++, and the library there is very similar. You have to kind of look at the references in the references to find out what sign conventions they use for spin weights and so on. So if you're doing computational physics, this is unfortunately part of it. Let's set another coefficient to 1. So this is what I guessed is L0 M minus 1. And that should be something, I don't know, that varies in the x direction or something. It kind of does, could be, right? Why not? Or this one, I'm guessing, is the L1 M0 mode. And yeah, my screen is too small. And this looks a bit, is that correct? Yeah. So if you imagine this is near the north pole of the sphere, the equator near the south pole, positive here, negative here, that it's kind of like the z coordinate. This is probably the L1 M0 mode here. So with a bit of digging, you can find out and convince yourself that this actually works. We can also do the inverse transform. I need to copy this PA here. And then, oh yeah, they have these plans. So what they call plan is essentially a different representation of an operator. So a plan for a Fourier transform is a thing that can perform a Fourier transform, which is essentially a linear operator. So Julia uses this matrix multiplication syntax. And then we get A and, oh, great. Sorry, need to rewind everything. I don't know what happened. See how it works. Where is it stuck? Okay, this will be a few minutes. Okay, let's let it simmer. Do you have questions? You're a bit frustrated about that. Yeah, you thought I'd present you some easy, nice, easy to use packages. Okay. Also something, I want to point to something theoretical in the meantime. Are we there? Well, let's wait a bit. This fast transforms package also supports the Padua transform. And the Padua transform is also something interesting. Let me switch off the lights and explain it on the blackboard. Because I've come across, of course, Fourier transform and YLM and Chebyshev and so on, but the Padua transform seems to be less well known. Let's assume you have a function that is given not in 1D but in 2D, and you want to sample the function. You want a spectral representation for that function. And in 1D, we know how to do that, use Chebyshevs, and in 2D, you might think a nice idea would be to do a tensor product ansatz. You have a function f of x and y, and you would sum that, summing over two variables I and j, and then you have coefficients I, j, and then you have the I Chebyshev in the x direction and the tay Chebyshev in the y direction, and then you have something like n by n points and a regular grid that I'm not, well, you know how a regular grid looks like. And that, of course, is a nice idea, and many people do it this way. But if you ask yourself the question very differently, if you want to get the best possible approximation, where should I put the collocation points? That's the same question we asked ourselves there in the beginning. Where should we put the collocation points in 1D to get the best possible approximation? And the answer was that they need to cluster up near the outer boundary. In 2D, putting them on a tensor product grid turns out not to be the best way. There's a much better way to put the collocation points. And in 2D, this is called the Padua transform. The Padua points are even explained on Wikipedia. Let me zoom in again. Can you see that graph here? Yeah. That is. So the line that is drawn here is just a construct to show you how you can calculate the Padua points. Switching off the lights again. And where the lines cross, or where the lines hit the outer boundary, this is where the Padua points lie. And what you do here, and here, and here, and here, and here. And instead of sampling the function in a regular grid, you would sample it at the Padua points. And then for the same number of points, you get a much more accurate representation of the function. And you can expand that to higher dimensions, 3D, 4D, etc. In 2D, there's this explicit equation that gives you this optimal representation. The locations of the Padua points can be just evaluated. In higher dimensions, 3D and 4D, it's not known where to put them, but you can kind of solve a global optimization point problem, and then you get a rather good representation that is still much better than a tensor product grid. And I ask myself why I'm not using these things in relativity in black hole simulations, but I don't know myself. Anyway, this gives you a much better representation because for a given number of points, the discretization error that you're getting, the approximation error, is much smaller. If I read this correctly, then the error here decreases corresponding to n, whereas if you use the tensor product, you'd need n squared in the exponential, the usual exponential, for an approximation. Yes? Mm.
The only difference of these two is just the dimensions.
That's the dimension. In 1D, it's well known. You do it along this these points that cluster up at the boundary. It has a cosine distribution. Here you use these figures, and in higher dimensions, there's no explicit formula that gives you the location for the optimal points. But of course, you can solve a numeric optimization problem to find points. And a tensor product grid is usually not a good idea for a spectral representation.
Base dependent, right?
Based on?
Base dependent.
Yes, this is for Chebyshev functions. It is base dependent. If you use the head functions for that we use for finite differencing, then equispace points are the best. And I don't know how things are for Legendre polynomials. I assume they look similar there. But if you want to have a spectral representation, then you can reduce the number of spectral basis points that you need for a given accuracy by a lot if you spread the points out cleverly instead of using a tensor basis. Tensor product basis. So let's see whether my Julia notebook has revived. Yes. Oh, you see all these 10 minus 17. Is there a chop function in Julia? Oh, let me briefly define a chop thingy here. I like that. Ah, no. It's this plus here. Yes. Chop x equals. Base chop. What? There is a chop function. Chop. What is jump? It's all for strings. I'm not using undo to get my function back. Here, chop one. There you go. Chop one works fine. And I delete that and. It's down here. I don't want it down here. I want a nice notebook where it's up here. And then I delete that. And then apply chop to the result. Ha, look how nice that looks. And yeah, we're getting just the coefficient back that we had originally. So the inverse spherical harmonic transformation is actually inverse. You don't pick up a weird factor of square root of 4 pi or something.
Sorry, what's the question mark do again?
That gives me documentation. That's not a Julia command. It is part bit into the command line here. And if you type question mark and, I don't know, print, it gives you information about the print statement.
Yeah, but what when you were defining chop one?
Oh, this? Yes, of course, yes. It's an if. This is the condition that's evaluated. And if it's true, it gives me a zero of the same type of x,
okay.
Because I don't want a zero of a different type. Otherwise, it gives me the x directly.
And then the colon x is just the return.
That's the then part if it's true, and that's the else part if it's wrong. It's kind of an if
okay.
Then else
yeah,
thing.
Got it. Thanks.
Yes, very good. Do you have questions regarding FFTs or other representations? Okay, some of you or most of you followed along. Would you feel comfortable programming something with Fourier transforms, for example, creating a Gaussian random field? I think that's good. Yes, okay. So. You saw Bill sitting in the corner. He left a few minutes ago. He was probably too bored by the lecture. He'll be giving the lecture next week about hydrodynamics. And because these are two different topics in short succession, I don't want to give you two different homeworks, but rather the homework will be on whatever Bill proposes, general relativistic hydrodynamics. And this is just an add-on that you can use. I think it'll be useful in the end, learning something about spectral transformations, but there won't be any homework on that. It's, yes? Pardon?
Does Python have an equivalent library?
FFTW quite likely has Python libraries.
I don't know.
Because that's
about the spherical harmonic thing.
No, I had a summer student looking at it, and he found something. And then the functions that he found, they went bad at L equals 18. So I'm not sure. Oh, wait, no Python does. Because all the cosmologists use Python, so you probably need to get a huge Python library, but then this works. One of them is called HeelPix.
Wow.
I'll write it down. It's the name of the package. It's a huge cosmological thing for observations, and they should have Python bindings as well, and there might be other Python bindings. If you can ask me by email or something if that remains a question. Of course, I recommend using Julia instead, but no, if you're working on a cosmology project, use Python. They all do. That's a good reason for that. Hmm.
I got a Stack Overflow error all the time in terms of the function abstract FFTs.
In abstract FFT? Yeah. Can you try to use FFTW instead? Might have mentioned artificial dissipation when we talked about solving partial differential equations. Here I want to mention filtering as well. It's going to be on the blackboard. If you have the function giving at collocation points, I call them fi, which is f at the xi, or whether you have the function given as some expansion coefficients and some basis, it's the same amount of information. If you apply a linear operation on these coefficients, it doesn't matter which you do. The derivatives are usually easier calculated in the spectral representation, but if you want to plot something, obviously you want to have this representation. If you apply a nonlinear operation, then it's much easier to do this using these collocation points. But one problem that you encounter here, if you have a nonlinear operation and you apply it to a function that is band limited, has a certain spectral representation, you get mode-mode coupling. That is the result of, for example, calculating f squared would have many more modes than you have initially. If you represent f using n modes, then f squared has 2n modes. And if you're not careful, then this can lead to trouble. Of course, what you want to do is you want to cut off the additional modes. You want to set them to zero artificially, because that's your discretization ansatz, and then continue to do something. But if you do the naive thing, say you have these coefficients ci, and then you evaluate it to get the fi, and then you square it, and then you, let's call it, what do you call it, project, no, what for, no, what was the opposite of evaluate? Anyway, you go back to, let's call it, back to get these coefficients here, then what you're doing here, you're not properly cutting off the additional modes that you introduce. Rather, there's an effect happening called aliasing, that the additional modes get folded back and introduce a lot of noise onto the modes that you have. So to avoid that, you can use filtering. And filtering means that you explicitly set a certain number of modes to zero. Of course, if you have n modes and certain number modes to zero, you're not left with n modes. So at some point, you have to go from n to 2n modes. Then you have to do a certain operation there, and then you filter back. So for example, you have these coefficients here given. You have 5 coefficients. Then you evaluate it at 10 different points. Then you introduce additional information. Of course, you don't add any non-zero things. It's equivalent to going from 5 modes to 10 modes, setting the additional modes to zero. At these 10 modes, you then perform the nonlinear operation. For example, you square things. And when you sample it back, then of course you can get 10 modes back. And then you can explicitly drop the additional modes. And then you're left with 5 modes corresponding to C squared. It was a bit more complicated to explain manually. Did you understand that? You're just looking at me smiling. Okay. I assume it's clear what I meant. Okay. Very good. This concludes the material that I prepared for today. We can stay here. You can continue to work on that, or we can meet on Wednesday. But on Wednesday, we won't be able to go over time because there's a colloquium again. We can work on Wednesday. And on Wednesday, I want you to implement something yourself in your Julia notebook that does something non-trivial with Fourier transforms or with spherical harmonics, which would be even cooler if you could do a nice visualization of the sphere. Thank you.